Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Good. I just had an eye appointment, and apparently they told me that my eyes are fine.
Yay. Yes. And for viewers, for listeners, I can see that you have two of them, not one. You're not like a cyclops or anything, which would be so awesome. Wouldn't that be great?
Oh, God bless me. Yes.
It would be great if you had glasses instead of glasses. We just had one big one and then two things to go over your ears.
Well, they always ask me if I want to go ahead and, you know, change my frames or, you know, this, that, the other. And I'm like,
oh my gosh, you are the least fashionista person that I know. Like you would say to them, yes, what frames go well with t-shirts and cargo shorts? And I don't mean that as a slam. I like that you're consistently sort of, is that guy a student or is that guy a professor?
Yeah, the number of times that when people ask me what I do and when I tell them I'm a college professor, they give me the once or twice look over and say, really?
Awesome. It's, you know, why, we dress in the library. We have a sort of a minimalist dress code in the sense that you're supposed to look, you know, reasonably professional and stuff, but we're allowed to wear jeans and that kind of thing. A lot of people don't, but it's, I'm not entirely certain that students care. I don't think they notice, and I don't think they care. I don't think they care what you wear. I think they care what you know. Speaking of things you know.
Yes.
So we're on the last couple of cases for the summer of SCOTUS. And yes. This one is a big one, right? Because this is about the Dreamers. This is about DACA.
That's right.
And there's a whole lot of machinations involved in this, right? It's not a simple case of, yay, DACA, we're done. Like, it's not even like that, right? There's a whole bunch of layers to this thing.
Yeah, there is a whole bunch of layers. The way the popular press reports Supreme Court rulings, you know, and I understand they have various constraints, they have various imperatives they have to respond to, but this
is
120
characters.
Yeah, and you know,
they're tweeting, and we have a lot more time to handle it.
Yeah, you know, and then they got to fit it at the bottom of the screen.
Oh, you know, right, scroll at the bottom of the screen, yep.
Yeah, but I mean, the case what we're talking about here is the Department of Homeland Security, versus the University of California. And it was a Supreme Court ruling that was handed down in the month of June of this year. And as Nia, as you pointed out, it concerned a program that was created during the Obama administration. In 2012, the Obama administration created the DACA program, which is the acronym for Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. And basically, it was a program that would give legal status with two-year renewable work permits for those young people who, through no decision or fault of their own, came to the United States illegally. In other words,
so your parents cross the border, they bring you with them because, hello, you're their kid, and you're 7 or 8 years old. You don't get to say, oh, is this breaking the law? We probably shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, right, okay.
You know.
Yes.
And then all this, so it allows them a way to legally stay here by showing that they're working or in college, or like there's a set of rules. You don't just get to say,
yeah, there was a,
because
yeah,
I want to. There's actually things you have to meet, criteria you have to meet, right?
That's right. It's a pretty standard, if you will, in terms of how it was set up, bureaucratic program, right? You had to have a job or be enrolled in college. You had to avoid committing criminal offenses that led to either a felony or a serious misdemeanor arrest and conviction. It was not a path to citizenship, okay? It was a kind of sort of stopgap measure because the Obama administration wanted Congress to pass a proposed legislation that was known as the DREAM Act. Thus, listeners, Nia's reference to the Dreamers, because those who would benefit from the program received the label, or if you will, title, the Dreamers. Okay. Now, what was unusual about how the Obama administration created this program was that the Obama administration did not go through the informal rulemaking required by the Administrative Procedures Act. Okay. They just went ahead and created it.
Am I correct that there are only two rules in the federal government? That there's the Commerce Clause and the APA?
I believe
and pretty much that's it. There's no other real rules in the American government. Everything else is just a guideline.
I believe other scholars would suggest otherwise. Unfortunately for you, Nia, you record a podcast with a constitutional and administrative law scholar, and the two dominant, if you will, pieces of either constitutional law or federal law that affects so much of what I teach, and for that matter, so much of what the federal government does, is actually the Commerce Clause, which is the constitutional basis for so much legislation passed by Congress. But yet, once they pass the legislation, then the bureaucrats have to, at minimum, follow the Administrative Procedures Act. Okay?
All right. Just saying, yes. For those listeners who want a shortcut to understanding pretty much everything about how the federal government works, learn those two things, and you're off to a huge start.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it, right?
Okay, so Obama just created this thing. He didn't go through.
Yeah,
he okay, did not. Okay, so what we mean by that is he did not put it out for review. He didn't ask for public opinion. He didn't do any of that. He's just like, poof, there it is.
Yeah, and the argument made by Obama is one that the Obama administration is one that we're pretty familiar with in regards to the current presidential administration, which is, I have this authority and I'm going to use it.
Combined with Congress is gridlocked and incapable of doing anything.
Yes.
Like, I mean, that's usually the secondary reason that they say, yes. Or that's the primary reason that they say they're going to use the power that they have, is because Congress won't do it.
Yes. And Nia, you are correct. The Obama administration, particularly during his second term, stated a number of times, we're going to go it alone because Congress refuses to work with us. Okay?
Oh, so they're basically saying, you're making me do this.
Yes. Okay.
Which the way kids pass off things to their siblings. My sibling made me do it.
Do this.
As opposed to Exactly. I have autonomy. Oh, no.
Yes. Okay.
I didn't want to, but they made me.
Yeah. You know, Mom, when I went ahead and broke one of your cardinal rules, I didn't really want to, but, you know, my older sister made me.
Right.
Okay. And of course, my mom would roll her eyes and say, yeah, that never worked. But nevertheless, many presidents say that, right? And the logic of the president is, hey, I was elected by the entire country. You, as a member of the House of Representatives, represents a little tiny district, okay, in the middle of nowhere, pick your state. Or you are one of two senators from a state, and by the way, that's one of 50 states. So my mandate is the entire country. Your mandate is to represent a little small pocket of a state, or one of 50 states.
Less than 2% or less of the population.
Population, right? Okay.
At maximum, right, for senators. So, yeah.
Now, this program was created in 2012. And since then, according to most estimates, well over 650,000. It's somewhere between 650,000 and 700,000. Residents. Okay, they're considered illegal because they're still they didn't come here legally, but they are. They have these permits. Okay, it's not a path to citizenship. That still has not been yet worked out. And by the way, if you want to know why a president just can't create a path to citizenship, for these people, it's because Congress has that authority. Okay.
Oh, citizenship is determined by the Congress?
That's right. Okay. Congress has that authority. It's in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. So it would have to be a law to make this permanent. So this is not a permanent path to citizenship. Now, Donald Trump is running for president in 2016. He makes it very clear that if he's elected president, he's going to rescind DACA. He makes that very clear. Now, some people believe that he wanted to rescind DACA because he's anti-immigrant. He said a number of times, I'm doing this because I want Congress to actually pass legislation, to give them a path to citizenship.
Okay? And can I say, I don't disagree with that. I mean, there's something to be said of, all right, well, then I'll make you do something. If you won't do it on your own, then I'll shove you far enough into a corner that you have to do it. I'm not sure that I disagree with President Trump on that.
Yeah, even if I don't like necessarily perhaps his motives.
Right.
Okay.
Or how he did it.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it. There are advocates on all sides of the immigration policy issue in this country that have long argued this country is overdue, okay, for immigration reform. We've not had significant immigration reform since the Reagan administration.
Well, and we need to answer the question for these kids. We need to answer the question of, if you're going to be booted, then you need to be booted.
Booted.
And come back in a whatever we consider to be a proper way, or we need to make a provision that allows you a path to citizenship so that you can be done with this and not have it hanging over your head. I mean, I know a lot of people who are in this situation probably worry about it, right? They worry consistently.
Oh, I have students who are in this country because of the DACA program, right? And it's every 2 years they got to renew the permit, right? They don't know if they're going to be deported, if their parents are going to be deported, okay? And if we're going to say to them, yes, you are deported because you came here illegally, then we need to take the official step and say it, okay?
Right.
And say it so that the country can go ahead and consider the fact that, nearly all of these dreamers didn't do anything wrong on their own. Okay.
And a huge number of them were quite young when they came.
Yes.
When somebody says go back to Mexico, they're like, I don't know Mexico. I don't know anybody in Mexico. I don't speak Spanish. Like, I can go somewhere, but it's not going back there in the sense that I have any real idea about how that culture plays out, country.
And as some advocates point out. The country needs to go ahead and say to these young people, notwithstanding all the contributions you make, we're still going to deport you. Do you have the guts to say it?
Right.
Okay.
Well, and do you have the kindness to end people's in-between status?
Yes. Yes.
Just settle it one way or another. So if that's really his reasoning, I'm actually not opposed to that. Make somebody do something.
So Trump comes into office, and while he was running for office, there was a related case dealing with another program that was created for the parents of these children. It's called DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans in Lawful Permanent Residence. Okay? Now, that was challenged in federal court, and the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals held that the DAPA program violated not only the 10th Amendment, i.e. federalism / states' rights, but also the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. Okay? When that court ruling was appealed to the United States Supreme Court, okay, court could not come to an agreement, okay, on the outcome, okay? And I believe that that Supreme Court case occurred when there were only 8 justices because Justice Scalia had died. So that meant that the lower court ruling stood. So Trump wins the presidency. His then Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, and for those listeners who pay attention to elections in various states, Jeff Sessions,
Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions.
was the Attorney General. He gave up his longstanding seat in the Senate representing the state of Alabama. He ran for the Republican Party nomination for the election for his old seat this fall, and he just lost the primary against the former head football coach of the University of Auburn, Tommy Tuberville. Okay. So Jeff Sessions, who once was part of the Trump administration inner circle, now looks like he won't have any government job in the foreseeable future. Yes, it was that Jeff Sessions. Sessions rules or issues in an, or makes a decision. He comes out and says that based on the logic of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in the DAPA case, then DACA also has to be both unconstitutional and illegal. The Department of Homeland Security takes that finding by the Attorney General and says, we are rescinding DACA. But the Department of Homeland Security doesn't immediately go through notice and comment. And that gets challenged by various interest groups, but also, okay, the University of California, because the University of California has a pretty significant number of students enrolled in their various universities who are, you know, recipients of the DACA program. So,
okay. And the University of California, just as a side note, for listeners who may not know this, is the largest university consortium
system in the country.
By far. It has, by number of schools, but also number of students. It's just a huge program. So when the University of California decides a thing, it reverberates through other universities all over the nation because of the sheer size of it. It's kind of like when Texas adopts a textbook for its middle school. There are more kids in middle school in Texas than in any other state except California. So it tends to be that then everybody else adopts that textbook too. It's a similar idea. These huge systems can have an effect on the entire nation.
Yeah, because a lot of other university systems in a lot of other states, okay, are like, hey, if this is what California is doing for all of its students, then perhaps we ought to go ahead and look at doing the exact same thing. Okay. Now, the University of California's challenge was basically twofold. One, they argued that the Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner. And for you faithful listeners, in a previous podcast, we talked about the arbitrary and capricious standard that's part of the APA.
Yes, we're thinking about getting merch for that.
That's right. Yeah, getting some good swag that you guys can order online. Okay.
We'll figure that out at some point.
Yes, right? You know, because, you know, and by the way, these would be proceeds that would not go into our pocket.
Right. Okay? That would definitely go back into the library yes. and poli sci departments.
Yeah, right. Okay. But basically, the argument here was because the Department of Homeland Security and the Trump administration didn't follow, at least immediately, the APA, the decision to rescind DACA was arbitrary and capricious. The second argument that the University of California made was the constitutional one, which, by the way, the Supreme Court did not focus on when they ultimately took the case. And that was the rescission of DACA would violate the Constitution's, if you will, value or liberty of equal protection under the law, okay? That these students would be treated differently simply because, okay, they came to the country, you know, in an illegal manner. The court didn't focus on that, okay?
Is that Amendment 14th?
Yes.
Okay.
Which, interestingly enough, they were actually, the University of California was arguing applied to the federal government via the Fifth Amendment's due process clause. Okay. It's a kind of sort of the converse of what has been historically argued, okay, about how the 14th Amendment actually applies the rest of the Bill of Rights to the states. but nevertheless, the court followed what's known as the rule of strict necessity. Why decide a case on constitutional grounds when you can decide it on statutory grounds? Okay, because when the court rules on a case on constitutional grounds, it makes it so much more difficult to overturn what the court did, because the court is the last word on constitutional interpretation. If you rule it on statutory grounds, you basically leave it to the political branches to say, hey, we disagree with you, you being the court, and thus we're going to change the law. It's easier to change a law than it is to change the Constitution.
By about 900%.
Yes, right?
Like,
yeah, right?
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons why we've only had 27 amendments to the U.S. Constitution is that the process is so darn difficult.
Well, and the first 10 were zipped. I mean, like, what we've really yes. had are 17 amendments to the Constitution.
Yeah,
and those 17 have taken 250 years. Like, it's 220 yes. years. But still, I mean, it's yes. a, you know, the so first 10 were easy peasy. But after that, man, it took on a...
Yeah, the first 10 were decided by the first Congress in our country's history. It's taken yeah. the subsequent, you know, 200 plus years for the remaining 17. And by the way, we haven't had an amendment approved since, you know, the early 1990s. So, you know.
And we, yeah. you and I had planned to talk about that at some point in a future podcast, sort of the why we don't change the Constitution more often. And
yes.
and what that means for us as a country. But in this particular instance, they said, rather than going out and changing the Constitution, you could just apply APA properly and
yes.
and do this and do what you want to do.
That's right. Because Congress has delegated huge amounts of legislative authority to the executive branch, okay, to control immigration. We know this, right? And it's not just Trump. It's not just Obama. Okay. Presidents have historically had huge amounts of, you know, legislative authority in the, you know, policy area of immigration delegated, okay, to the executive branch. We know this, right?
Well, and neither Trump nor Obama is responsible for DHS. That was President George Bush.
That's right.
The second George Bush. 43.
Yeah, 43. And
that was post 9/11. I mean, there are reasons that all came together as one organization.
Yeah, and in one of the subunits, as you well know, Nia, because one of your master's degrees is in Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness, one of the units of the Department of Homeland Security is ICE, Immigration and Customs. Yes, immigration.
ICE, baby.
Yes, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, right?
Right.
And you also know this, and scholars pointed this out when the agency was being created or contemplated. Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security, has huge amounts of legislative authority delegated to it. Okay.
Oh, the USA Patriot Act basically said, here, do whatever you want.
Yes, right.
And here's a whole bunch of money to do it with. Like, there's amazing levels of things in there that people really don't, I think, know about. We've talked about FISA courts and we've talked about other things in the past, and we can go into more depth at some point if somebody really wants us to do that. But it's taking a deep dive into DHS, you will suddenly realize they have enormous power. They have enormous influence over not just federal agencies, but state agencies. Part of what the fight with the sanctuary city issue comes back to all of that as well. And so, yeah, there's a huge, a lot of power and a lot of legislative authority there. But that's not what the court found. That if you just, is this another one of those cases where the court basically said to Donald Trump, if you would just hire lawyers that understood the APA, you could be doing all kinds of stuff that you keep trying to do and not being successful?
Yes.
You would think that this message would take after a while.
Yeah, you know, hey, we're 3.5 years into his, you know, his term as president, and the court still is reminding him. I mean, and the Supreme Court's not the only federal court that has said this to the Trump administration, but you're right. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the four liberals and said the Trump administration did act in an arbitrary and capricious manner because they didn't follow APA.
And basically what he's saying there is two wrongs don't make a right. Like, just That's because right. Obama did, the Obama administration did that, doesn't mean you get to do that too.
That's right. Okay, because you now have 670,000 people who have grown to rely on DACA. To take that away from them, you have to follow the Administrative Procedures Act. Now, what's interesting to note here, and we can discuss this a little bit further in regards to implications, Roberts' majority opinion, and by the way, even those in the dissent, particularly those in the dissent, but, you know, 4 out of the 5 justices in the majority agreed with Roberts' point that Trump could rescind DACA. Okay.
So yeah, this was a reprieve. This was not a,
yeah, this was not a, you get to stay in it and the program can never go away. No, what Robert said was the program could have been rescinded if the Trump administration had followed the Administrative Procedures Act.
Which basically gives them, as he's done before in other rulings this summer, gives them sort of a roadmap of, if you do it properly, this is how you can do it, and it would stand up constitutionally.
That's, yeah. Well, and but also stand up legally.
Or statutorily, yeah. I guess.
Yes, statutorily. You know, constitutionally, I mean,
They didn't answer that question.
You no, they just said they didn't answer that question.
I mean, so I shouldn't have. Yeah, that was me misspeaking.
No, you raise a larger point here, which is, you know, there are some justices on the current Supreme Court who would like to tackle the issue of whether or not Congress can delegate so much authority to the executive branch largely unchecked. But Roberts didn't go there, right?
Am I guessing that one of those justices is Alito?
Basically, it's the other four conservatives.
Yeah, because I can see Alito saying, okay, you know what? This is a mess, and we need to figure it out, and we just need to rule constitutionally and tell people how to do it and how to do it properly.
Yeah, I mean, because their logic is when Congress delegates huge amounts of authority to the executive branch, but with very few guidelines on how that authority should be exercised, that violates the non-delegation principle, i.e. separation of powers. Because in the Constitution, it doesn't say the executive branch gets to go ahead and make regulations, okay, which have the effect of law. The only law-making body in our federal Constitution, according to at least four of the justices, is Congress.
I agree with that.
Okay.
I mean, they're the representatives of the people. Of the theory people. is that they make the laws that govern the people who represent, like, who they represent.
Yep. Okay.
So I would be in line with that, although I'm not in line with some of the other stuff they've said. So I don't know where I would fall. I would be John Roberts if I were on the Supreme Court, because he goes with his heart. Like, he goes not with his heart. That's not accurate, because it's not an emotional decision. He goes with where he really thinks the law lands. Like, he looks at what he thinks the principle of the law is, and he says, you know, I'm gonna say that, like, he voted with the liberals in this particular instance, not because he has the liberal position, but because he looked at the letter of the law and said, you didn't do it right. If you had done it right, we would be upholding it.
Yeah, as a number of commentators about this case pointed out, the majority's ruling in this case is a very narrow technical ruling. Okay. It basically went ahead and said, yes, Mr. President, you have the authority to rescind DACA if that's what you choose to do. But if you choose to do that, you have to follow the rules. And the rules are laid out in the Administrative Procedures Act. Okay.
Can I just comment that it seems a lot like the Supreme Court rolls up a newspaper and bats somebody across the face with it?
Yes.
Sometimes it's the executive, sometimes it's Congress. Sometimes it's a state.
Yes.
Like, hey, Georgia, come here. You know, like they did this summer earlier with the annotations. Like, there's all these, it's like they keep a rolled up newspaper on the bench and they say, all right, who are we going to smack across the face with this thing? But it also, this is also another one of those give if taketh away things that we've talked about before, because right now those kids are safe. Right now.
Yes.
But if August 1st, the president put in the Federal Register that he wanted to get rid of DACA, and he had an explanation, and he, you know, explained why he wanted to do that and gave a comment period, which I think is 30 days.
30 days.
And as early as September 1st, it could be done.
Sure.
If they were organized and got it in.
According to administrative law scholars, Nia, typically informal rulemaking, notice and comment rulemaking, takes about a year and a half. Okay? Takes about a year and a half.
Is that because it takes a while to write the regulation to start with?
You got to do the research. You got to demonstrate that, you know, you just didn't come up with it over the weekend. Okay.
like I would do. Okay.
Okay. That you vetted it with the agencies that have, you know, substantive authority.
Okay.
You
looked at its feasibility, you looked at the cost, you looked at all that stuff.
Because there's another federal law that says the Office of Management and Budget has to do a cost benefit analysis of every proposed regulation. Okay, that affects so many people. Okay.
Oh, so even if you're rescinding one, you still have to do a CBO report?
Yes.
No,
CBO. No, an OMB report. OMB cost benefit analysis, right? Cost benefit analysis. But again, federal agencies know how to do these things. These are checking boxes, right? So you do all that, then you issue the proposed rule in the Federal Register. And in a previous podcast episode, we talked about what that's like, right? You give the interested parties 30 days to respond. And everybody that responds could dislike the proposed rule.
And you can say, I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of me doing it anyway.
That's right.
Because you don't have to take their advice. You just have to ask for their advice.
That's right. Thank you for sharing, right? You know,
how nice that you have feelings. Moving on.
Yeah, moving on, right? And it on average, it takes about a year and a half, right? So, you know, theoretically, if the Trump administration wanted to go ahead and check all the boxes, you know, and in you know the infamous acronym for bureaucrats, CYA.
Yes.
Cover your butt, right? Okay. But you know, you do that. Okay. One, this could have already been done. But two, let's say Trump issues a proposed Okay. Let's say hypothetically, Donald Trump wins a second term this November. Okay. January, he issues a proposed rule rescinding DACA, right? Because he would have had 6 to 7 months since the Supreme Court ruling to already study the issue.
Right.
Give it 30 days. At some point in February, the comment period ends. A month later, you go ahead and say, here is the final regulation rescinding the DACA program, okay? And even with the subsequent court challenges to it, okay, by the end of 2021, okay, DACA could be rescinded. That's the scary thought for DACA recipients.
Right.
That's the scary thought, right?
The happy thought is that the Trump administration does not seem to have gotten itself together.
Yes.
On these issues previously, it seems like they take a shot, they don't get it, and then they kind of give up and move on to the next thing. And that, I'm going to venture an opinion, has to do with lack of experience. A huge number of them lack the experience to say, there's a way we do this, and then when we do it that way, we're sort of Teflon, right? We can actually do what we want to do. And that is in part because a huge number of the people in Donald Trump's administration are new to
working in government.
A lot of it, Jeff Sessions aside, who had been in government since dinosaurs roamed the earth. but you know, him aside, very few of them, there are a few secretaries that have been in government for a long time, but generally speaking, he has chosen people from the private sector. And this is one of those instances where an insider would have been helpful
to his cause. There are three set of phenomenon here that probably should give quite a bit of hope to DACA recipients. One you just mentioned. President Trump has picked a significant number of non-government, people with very little government experience. Two, even when he's picked those individuals for cabinet positions, it appears as though he, with some regularity, ignores them. Okay.
Oh, that's true. Okay.
Okay, and then third, he's done something that you and I've talked about, that a large number of public administration scholars have identified. He has hollowed out the federal bureaucracy. There are so many positions, middle and upper management positions, people who would be tasked with implementing regulations, those positions are vacant. they are vacant. And because they are, sure, he can go ahead and claim the federal bureaucracy is the smallest it's been in decades. But the problem is, in terms of implementing his policy choices, there just aren't people there to go ahead and implement them. They're just not. Okay.
I'm going to ask a separate question, but it's a follow-up to this idea. So let's just say that President Trump's administration begins the work now.
Yes.
And they actually manage to get something in the Federal Register in late November.
Okay.
Let's just pretend.
Okay.
And they haven't won the election. Can the new administration remove something from comment, or can they? Okay.
Yes. Yep. Yes, they can. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So you have no way of affecting that once you're post your presidency.
That is correct.
Other than to stand up and publicly say things, which is what ex-presidents do sometimes. Although they don't seem to do that as much. I mean, like, they don't seem to do that hugely. They don't seem to be, they seem as a group to not be people who speak negatively against the current occupant of the White House. That does seem to be the tradition. It will be interesting to see what Donald Trump does, post his presidency, whenever that is, whether that's in 2020 or 2024. It will be interesting to see if he follows that sort of tradition of, for the most part, you stay out of things that the current president is dealing, you don't venture opinions
because
for the most part.
Yeah, because most former presidents understand how difficult the job is, and they understand that whoever is the next occupant doesn't need, former presidents
nagging or making fun or doing anything other than being silently supportive of them as a person.
That's right.
Yep. Right. Even if you're opposite what they believe in platform, they're still a person, and they're still under an enormous stress. It's interesting when they do speak out, because it is so rare.
Yes.
So where does it take us with DACA? Like, so right now, if you were a DACA recipient, you're okay. You just have to make sure your 2-year paperwork mark is filled out.
Yes.
And you can continue to go to school, have your job, stay in the United States. What happened with the parents?
Right now with the parents, the Trump administration, if they had probably more money and more staff, could be deporting many more of them out of the country.
Okay, so it's at this point a staffing and financial issue.
Yes. Yeah. And again, this is one of those times where how Trump has treated the bureaucracy and how Trump has negotiated with Congress in regards to the budget has actually impacted his ability to probably affect the kind of policy change that he's wanted. Yep.
I think that it must be very hard for Donald Trump to adjust to the idea. He hasn't seemed to adjust to it yet, that being a CEO is very different, very, very different than being the president.
Yes.
Just because you say you want something as a president doesn't make it happen. You're better off in that instance being, Kim Kardashian, than you are being the president, if you want your word to just carry, just carry you through, kind of thing. So I think he's so used to being sort of the I say a thing and somebody makes it happen, that I think maybe it's been hard for him to adjust, not only to the fact that you don't get to just say a thing and it magically happens, but also that the sheer volume of people that it takes to run something as large as the federal government. And this goes to the idea too of, there are many people in this country, and it's not just one side or the other of the political spectrum, but on both sides of the spectrum, who would like to see a smaller, more effective government. And if you were going to have that, you would need to be, it would need to be not in any way arbitrary about which positions you didn't fill. Like, you would have to really sit down and focus on, okay, if I want the work of DHS to get done, who do I absolutely have to have in those jobs? And I'm not entirely sure that that happened either.
Oh, no.
Because understanding that bureaucracy takes a long time. Like, that's a years long.
Yeah.
I've been studying government documents and government stuff for 28 years, and I still discover agencies where I say, what the heck is that? And then I realize it's, you know, six people in this grouping that do this thing, and if they don't do this thing, then a bunch of other people can't do their jobs. And if I've devoted that much time and effort to it, and I'm still behind, like, there's no way for
somebody who's not been in government, who gets elected president, is going to have a steep learning curve.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. I have sympathy for that, because that's hard. That's a really hard.
Yeah. There are a couple phenomena that your comment kind of sort of touches upon. One, you know, people who become presidents who have not worked in government previously struggle with the fact that if they want to get major policy change written into law, they have to convince Congress to do it. Okay. And that's difficult. Okay. Even if Congress was not polarized like it has been over the last 2 to 3 decades, that's still difficult. But right. Then second, you talked about the bureaucracy, right? And you know, the bureaucracy is, you know, I've been studying public administration, you know, for, you know, a couple decades now. You know, you and I've talked about this book before, and I encourage readers to pick it up if you can. And it's not a long book, and it's written by a pretty well-known former reporter, Michael Lewis. It's called The Fifth Risk. And so much of the book is about the Trump administration's transition from the campaign to actually taking over the executive branch. And even my students, okay, many of whom are public administration, you know, students, you know, their concentration is public administration, are just mesmerized. They're just awed, okay, by what they end up learning about the federal bureaucracy in that book. You know, like, so for instance, the Department of Commerce, okay, would seemingly be about, okay, you know, trade, right? You know,
commerce. Oh, there's so much under the commerce.
Okay, but exactly, Nia, right? You know, so for instance, you know, the National Weather Service is part of the Department of Commerce.
Right.
Okay.
Measures, weights and measures is part of commerce.
Commerce.
Which has almost nothing to do with commerce now, because we hardly ever sell anything by you know, weights and measures, but measures.
That's
the census is under commerce.
The Commerce Department, right? I mean, and many of my students are like, what the heck is the census? Okay. That's like, well, you know, hey, that's where we put it, right?
Right. Okay. Right.
It made sense at one point, right? Okay. You know, the federal government's largest loan program is actually in the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep. And students think it's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, and, you know, it's like housing and student loans. I'm like, oh, no, it's farm loans. It's farm subsidies.
And small business, mm-hmm. right? And they're just like, what the heck's that got to do with it? The Department of Agriculture, okay, is the biggest lender in the United States, right? Okay, and if my students who are interested in this stuff are just blown away, imagine if you are somebody who's never worked in government before, and Donald Trump had never worked in government. All of a sudden, he becomes president, okay, and he's getting a daily briefing where somebody says, hey, Mr. President, what do we want to do about the Small Business Administration's loan program? He's just like, huh? What? What?
Well, I think we should keep that. Sir, that's not really what I was asking. I mean, like, then there's the whole idea of competing interests. Like, the entire government is competing interests.
Yes.
The loans that are given in ag aren't given in some other department, right? So they're not given in energy. They're not given in whatever else. So you have to decide when the budget isn't just about, oh, well, these people need a couple $1 trillion, so I'll just throw it their way. It's taking all of those competing interests into account and saying, well, I want to balance this with this, and I want to give a certain amount of energy loans and a certain amount of ag loans and a certain amount of, you know, and then there's things like in the Constitution where it says, and thou shalt have a census, and it doesn't give any more information than that, right? Doesn't tell you how you're supposed to do it, how much it's supposed to cost, what kind of information you're supposed to gather. So all of that's competing interests. And we saw earlier with the court case about whether to have the citizenship question. There's huge competing interests in that. For a person who's, and I'm not trying to be ugly, because it's not just Donald Trump. Every CEO is self-interested first. Sure, like that's how you get to be a CEO.
Yeah, because your job is to go ahead and make, your job as CEO of a corporation is to make shareholders a whole bunch of money, right?
But I would say that it's to look after yourself first. How did you get to be CEO?
Okay, fair enough.
You had to put your own personal interest before everybody else. And he's used to doing that. So is Jeff Bezos. So was Steve Jobs. So is, you know, Lee Iacocca, if we want to go back a billion years. That's a thing that's natural to people who rise to that position. And then somebody says to them, oh, well, if you're president, you put yourself last.
Yes.
Because the American people have to come first. And talk about a gear shift. Like, that's a really hard, I would think it would be a really hard gear shift to make. And especially if the people you've hired around you are similar to you. They are, their interests have a lot to do with their own personal achievement. I think that would also be difficult as well. And I think that's one of the reasons he struggled with people who have long served in the government, whose worldview is, no, the people come first, or
we got to follow this process. Okay. Which may not necessarily lead to the outcome, the end goal that you want.
Right.
So, you know, to your comment a few minutes ago, of how people on both sides of the political aisle frequently struggle with this. You know, I have students, okay, who are activist, progressive, liberal, right? And they want change now. And then I remind them, you know, kind of sort of like in this podcast where I go ahead and weird things up, right? Complicate things, right? I'm like, okay, but you understand you have to go through this process. And they're just like, yeah, but, and I'm like, yeah, but there's no but here, right?
Right, because if we run on feelings only, and yours isn't the loudest voice in the room, are you going to appreciate being under someone else's worldview?
That's right.
Like, the whole point of that is to protect the minority. It's to protect the small, shouty voice that's saying, no, my needs aren't being met, right? And if you start deciding by the volume of the voice,
or the immediacy, okay. I mean, the reason why the Administrative Procedures Act, okay, has this process that we've described in this episode is to avoid arbitrary and capricious behavior.
Right.
You don't want to be subject to arbitrary and capricious behavior, right?
No.
Okay.
You don't.
No.
Anybody who's ever been ruled by a toddler. Doesn't, like, remember Mackenzie's toddler years where you were like, oh, at some point I'm going to be able to say no and she's not going to burst into a screaming fit of tears and sobbing, right? Like,
yes.
But you remember those days when you were, yes, like, give it to her, whatever it is, so she will stop screaming.
Yes.
You don't want to be ruled by a toddler. You want to be ruled by a person who has reason and who, whether you disagree with their argument or not, actually has an argument and can say, you know, like, I don't I don't want to see these kids thrown out of the United States. I will state openly for the record, I don't think it was their fault they were brought here. And I think that they need to be given a path to citizenship in some way. I'm not saying that it should be
wholeheartedly.
I don't think that it should be just a magic wand. I mean, I think they should have to have a clean record. They like the things they have now. They should have to have a job or be in college, right? Like they should be productive members of society. But beyond that, I say, yes, we should come up with something. And so if that really is the motivation, I'm in. I'm in with Donald Trump. I'm in with saying, okay, if the way I have to do this, if the way I have to force your hand is to scare the snot out of people and say, in 6 months, this is going away. Congress, you've got 6 months to fix it, which is what I hope he would do. I would hope that they would say, okay, we've rescinded it, but we're giving Congress 6 months before we actually start throwing people out of the country to get together.
Yes.
And yeah. Figure something out. I would be totally behind that because I think that that's a good legal way to do it that gives everybody a voice at the table. I don't want somebody to just be able to say poof and then the next day this ground that I've thought that I was standing on no longer exists, because that scares me for groups like this group of people. But it also scares me for groups like that aren't vulnerable, but could be made vulnerable by someone's lunacy.
Well, or another president that comes in and says, I'm going to emphasize this instead of that in immigration policy, right? I mean, you could have a president that comes in and says, okay, I'm going to go ahead and give a permit program for people with certain job skills that we don't have enough of in our native population, but everybody else has to get deported. Huh? Right?
Oh, yeah. See, no, that would be terrible.
Okay, but that's the basis of one of our visa programs, right? Okay, do you have a job skill, okay, that this administration believes is important to our economy?
Right, but I don't mind if we have that up front, but if what we do 2 years later is say, yeah, no longer we need those skills, and so you have to go away, now we're going to bring in people with a different set of skills.
Okay, but again, under current immigration law, the authority to make those determinations, it rests with the executive branch, and that can vary depending on who's in the White House.
Which is why we need the APA.
Yeah, that's why we need the APA. And also, maybe, you know, members of Congress should get off their duffs and actually pass, okay, meaningful immigration law that says these are our priorities. Oh, by the way, in the 21st century, what worked in the 20th century doesn't seemingly work anymore in regards to immigration policy. So, you know, we might want to update this. Because nobody believes that immigration is going to go away as a policy problem.
Right. And us not addressing it for 40 years is pretending that the world is not the place that it is now.
Yeah, right. Okay. So it's, you know, it's the dreamers. It's the dreamers' parents, right? It's the acknowledgement that, you know, hey, our borders, okay, might need to be addressed. I don't know if the wall is the appropriate way, but you know, are we concerned?
Right.
Okay. But right now, okay, everybody's locked into their position. They're not coming to the table to negotiate. So we are left with, well, whoever wins the presidency gets to go ahead and decide the fate of, as in the case of DHS versus the University of California, 670,000 people. I don't know about you, but that's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
Okay.
I'm not interested in us just arbitrarily doing something to those people. I would like there to be a systematic, something that they understand and something that we understand. Like, I don't know. I would like for us to not have that be arbitrary and capricious.
Yeah, right?
Turns out me and John Roberts, we're right in there together in that sense.
And you know, and I have students, okay, where I'm like, you know, I don't know what to tell them because they're just like, what do you think's going to happen? And I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
Okay. And all I want to do is be able to go ahead and tell them, hey guys, this is the law. This is the process. This is what you can expect. Right. It kind of sort of touches upon, you know, another podcast episode that's going to be released either next week in a couple weeks. Okay. We're at a point to where this is almost the definition of lawlessness.
Right.
It will depend on who's president.
Yeah, no, we need to, we need to stop that. Yeah. I'm not comfortable with that either. Cause it's so arbitrary. It will change from president to president to president.
Right. Okay.
We need to fix it.
And I understand that's the basis of so much of the modern administrative state, but as somebody who teaches it, okay, I'm not comfortable with it. Okay.
And not having predictability is bad for a society. Like it's just bad for us.
Yes. Okay. I mean, the law should be able to, if you will, encourage reliance.
Right.
Can you rely on what is the meaning of X? Right. And I know that sounds really boring. Okay. Really. But you know, hey.
Oh man, you know what we sound like? We sound like old people. You kids get off my lawn. Like we want predictability, we want reliance, we want it to be but those values help everybody.
But Nia, think about all the students that we work with, okay, whose performance, whose ability to do good work is affected when, you know, other parts of their life they can't rely on.
Right.
When they're
homeless,
not secure.
Homeless students truly struggle in college to do anything.
Yes.
Because they're so stressed about finding a place to sleep that's safe. And
you know, they're worried about whether or not one of their, you know, family members is going to get deported. Right.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. That's
not good. Right. And we should aspire to be better as a society. Okay. And I don't know what the answer is to the rather complicated large immigration problem, but what's going on right now, okay, isn't good, okay. And whether or not John Roberts, okay, in a narrow majority of the court went ahead and slapped Donald Trump on the nose with the newspaper, okay, that isn't the way to go ahead and run, okay, a significant federal government program.
Right.
It just isn't. Okay.
Well, and it's not tenable. It's got to be handled at some point. You can only run so far before you've run around in a full circle.
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Well, normally we end on a happy note and we're not this time. Sorry, listeners. It's complicated. It's nuanced. It's hard. What we would encourage is that if you have commentary about this, make it to your senators, make it to your representatives.
Try to
reach out and say, hey, let's get working on this. This thing is important. It may not directly affect anybody in your life, but it probably indirectly does. So we would encourage you to get involved if you have feelings on this.
Yes.
Thank you so much for talking to me about this, Augie.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad we did.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.